Session number 30505.
General Sir John Mogg, Real One. When and where were you born, General?
Well, it's a long time ago, Harry. I was born in 1913 in Canada. And the reason I was born in Canada was that my father, who had served in the Wiltshire Yeomanry and then the Canadian Engineers in the First World War, was badly wounded in 1917, and he came back to England, having been out in Canada, because he was one of 11 children, the son of a canon who lived at Bishop's Canning's in Wiltshire. And my grandfather suddenly said to him one day, "Do you know, we have got about 400 or 500 acres left to us, the whole family, in Canada, and nobody's been to see it. You better go and have a look at it." So in 1911, he went off to Canada and started cutting the trees back and the bush back just near the Rocky Mountains in British Columbia. And just before he'd gone there, he'd met my mother, and there was a certain amount of opposition to them both getting married. My other grandfather said that she was too young or something. So she, being a very courageous woman, decided, right, I'll go and sort this out myself. And so off she went across the Atlantic on her own. In those days, it was something quite unheard of. And she got, went across by a Cunard liner, got into the train at the Canadian Pacific Railway on her own, went right across Canada, and got out at Vancouver, and then somehow or other, I'm not quite sure how, but she got into the bush where my father was, and they lived in a little wooden shack where he was cutting trees around and lumbering. And as is usual, within 2 years, I arrived. And I know that the doctor had to come 30 miles away. And so my mother went through a very rough, and the only people around us here were other very tough Canadian lumbermen. And there she was, about the only woman. However, the whole thing went awfully well. And then my father joined up, as I said a minute ago, in the First World War, badly wounded in 1917 in the leg, got a military cross. And then we all went back to Canada again. And I went to school in Victoria, because he found that he couldn't manage the farming side of it. And he got a job in the customs and excise in Victoria. And we lived down in Oak Bay. I can see it now, a tiny little sort of bungalow-type house. And I went to St. Michael's School when I was 4 years old, which was very young in those days to go to school, run by a family called Simons, and a father and two sons. And I was extremely happy there. I remember my school reports were absolutely frightful. The headmaster always used to say, "They're a very nice little boy, and he's my right-hand man, but I wish he could pass the exams." So perhaps that's how I became a general, I don't know. And that finished in when I was 12 and a half. And my uncle, who had a bit of money, was very kind to me, and he paid for my education in England. And so my mother and I came home, leaving my father out in Canada, in 1926, at the year of the general strike. I remember we couldn't get our luggage off the ship, and we couldn't get a taxi, and we made our way eventually to London, had a night in London where I was kitted up with school uniform for Morden College, where I got in because they all thought I'd be too stupid to pass the exams without paying to pass the exams. So that was a bit of influence by my uncle, I think, who was paying the bills. And I went down to Morden, where, I enjoyed most of it, but some of it I didn't enjoy, until I became a prefect there, and that I quite enjoyed, except I didn't like the head of my house very much, and he and I used to fight a bit. And so the only reason I did any work was to get away from him, so I used to go and study in my study. Probably the only reason why I passed the what was it, equivalent to A-levels in those school certificate.
What was the discipline of the school like?
Very tough, and there was no... I was beaten about once a month, I suppose, for doing all sorts of terrible things, but I don't think it did me any harm. And they were many, always what a foolish prank. So there was, in those days, still a discipline with the prefect. And I was a fag, and you used to come in here, you used to hear your name shouted by some person. You had to go and do some task for some prefect. And that could be overdone, and there were occasions when it was overdone. On the other hand, you got through it somehow or other, and you learnt the sort of, perhaps the first elements of discipline, in that when you were told of something, you did it. I remember getting beaten by the headmaster with a friend of mine, who was a well-known trainer now, racehorse trainer, and I remember on a Sunday afternoon, we both had blank cartridge pistols, and we thought it would be great fun to go and ambush the local girls' school, which was called the Morven Girls' College, and they used to go out in a long crocodile on a Sunday afternoon for a walk. And one of us got either side of the hedge, and when we got into the middle of the crocodile, we loosed all six rounds each and then ran like hell. Unfortunately, we were seen. And that was supposed to be a terrible crime. I don't know why. And anyhow, we were up in front of the headmaster, which is the worst punishment you could get. The next day is you get expelled. We got through that one, all right. And then from there, after... through anything more about Morven? No.
I was going to ask you if there was any master who particularly stood out in your mind as having an influence upon you.
Mostly the sports masters, I seem to remember. The headmaster was a chap called Preston, and he was a kindly old man, and I always remember at the leaving dinner, he always made a speech about the leavers, and I was supposed to be always dreaming at the back of the class. I always remember that remark he made at me. But he said I would be very highly suitable to go into the army, because I was in the army class there. However, my parents were determined that I should go into a family, a business which had family connections.
Could I just come in there,
yeah.
General? The army class, how was that organized in
school?
Well,
there was a special side which put emphasis on mathematics and science, if you were going to the army, you joined that. It was quite a small section in the school. It was called the Army Class, and there was Army Class, I can't quite remember, there were various grades of it, and the top grade was, I think, Army Class 5. And apart from having a special syllabus curriculum, which suited the Army exams that you were going to have to take, there was no difference in anything else. I mean, you did most of the sort of normal things that you do, normal curriculum, but there's more emphasis on those subjects.
There was no OTC or anything?
Oh, yes, there was an OTC, yeah, but everybody joined that in those days. It is slightly at the moment in some places where it is very unpopular, and I think sometimes an OTC is the biggest deterrent to anybody joining the army. On the other hand, when it's well run, it's good and people enjoy it.
And how was it? How was
nothing
it
worse than when it's badly run.
How was it run and organised at your college?
So I remember rightly now, we had one afternoon a week in which we did 2 hours military training, and it was mostly drill, which was very unpopular, a little bit of shooting, and there was an exam, which I can't remember what it was called now, I can't remember, and it was a sort of classification which you should have all passed when you were at the when you joined the Corps. But apart from one afternoon or 2 hours a week military training, there was always the annual camp, which we did for 10 days or a fortnight at places like Tidworth and Salisbury Plain or wherever it was. And that was quite fun, living in a tent and doing sort of rather ragged sort of manoeuvres. And the great scheme was to have your rifle with a blank cartridge and put one of the school pins down the rifle. Of course, that was very dangerous indeed. People didn't realize it. Somebody got shot in the leg doing it once. But those sort of pranks, letting people's tents down, utterly childish things. We were just the same as everybody is now in that way.
Was the unit attached to a county regiment or something like that?
Yes. I have a feeling that the Morven OTC was attached to the local Worcestershire regiment. Yes, certainly. But there were, again, other sections which you could join. There's the Royal Corps of Signals side of it. They had a side of it, the signals. But I think that the overall administration was watched by the Worcester Regiment, and you had a sort of regimental sergeant major, and one of the masters who had military background was the commanding officer of the Corps. It was quite fun at times, but again, not very well run. On the other hand, you've got the sort of elements of military organisation in that you were formed into sections and platoons, and you had a platoon commander, and you changed around and got a chance to be a section commander. So you've got elements of leadership in the training that you did, but it was pretty elementary. However, I don't think it was too bad a thing. Well, then, as I said a minute ago, my parents were very keen for me to go into a firm where we had family connections, and I had an uncle in called Jardine Medicine in the Far East, and in particular this one was in Sarawak, where the Brooke family were the sort of Rajas, and I was told that I could not go there until I was 20 because of all the Far East diseases and malaria and goodness knows what, and so I did a short business course in London for about 6 months. It didn't suit me too much. I wasn't too keen on the sort of business side of it. However, my parents were very insistent that I should continue this. And then I had a year at home with a very marvellous grandmother who supported me unbelievably and paid for all sorts of things for me to have a horses and enjoy myself tremendously. I used to borrow her car whenever I could. And after about a year of this and running around dancing and visiting the pubs, and I suddenly realised that I was a very revolting young man, and so I changed my mind about the business of the going to the Far East, and without telling my parents, I went into Oxford and enlisted in His Majesty's Army, as it was then, and I got my King's Shilling, and having taken some advice, having wanted to go into the local county regiment as an officer, they said, well, it'd be a good thing not to go into the same regiment as a rifleman or private soldier. And so I was bustled off to His Majesty's Coldstream Guards in Caterham with my pair of grey trousers and sports coat and little bag. And I arrived at the gate where...
What date was this, General?
This was May 1933. I remember a date I shall always be... have inscribed on my mind.
How did your parents take the news once you told them?
Not too good. On the other hand, they realised, I think, that my heart was in it. And it had been all the way along, really. I think that the sort of soldiery had always been what I wanted to do.
This was a childhood
growing had been, right. Yes, I think so. And, of course, my father had been also in the army. And I had nearly all my cousins, too, were all going into the army. And so there was a quite sort of family tradition about it. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. I think it helps you in a way, in that you know a bit more about it. Anyhow, I arrived at the gates at Caterham, where two very large guardsmen bundled me off from Easley to what's called a waiting room. And my feet didn't touch the ground at all for about 6 months. And I went into this huge barrack room where there were 24 other beds laid down and not a soul about. So I strolled around and was leaning up against the fireplace when suddenly I heard the most obscene language shouting at me, with words that I'd never heard of before. If I had, I didn't think I should use anyway. And he said, "What the something, something, something are you doing?" I said, "Well, I've just joined up, sir, you see." And this was a very old, slightly beer-ridden old sergeant with a big white moustache. And he said, "Where do you come from?" I said, "I come from Oxford." "Oh, university. I'll give you something the university by the time you've finished." By this time, I shrunk into a sort of miserable little frightened thing. And he then had me on the square, brushing out the leaves, because nobody else. So I was the only one there who had to wait till you had 24 people in the squad. And I was the first to arrive. So I had about a fortnight waiting for people to arrive. And all that time I did was clean out the loos and wash down the wash houses and, as I say, sweep leaves and do all the chores, work in the sergeant's mess or officer's mess, washing up things. Well, it did me all the good in the world, but I didn't think so at the time. And then we started really hard training, which really was, I had a wet shirt solidly for the rest of the time that I was there, either changing in about 3 seconds from uniform drill parade into PT kit or into sports kit. And we went absolutely flat out from about 6 in the morning till 6 at night. And then you'd sit down on your bed, and we had white buff uniform in those days, which has now gone out of fashion, but I had sort of white pouches and a white pack and white braces, and with brass things you had to clean, and you had at least 2.5 hours of cleaning this up every night. At the end of it, you had to take it up to an old trained soldier who was in charge of the administration of your lot of 24. And if he didn't like you, or if he found a speck of dust anywhere, the whole thing went into the coal box, where you had to start again. So that was a bit of brutal discipline, but it wasn't bullying, as seems to be said in fashionable at the moment, which I don't believe. I think it's grossly exaggerated. However, the whole time I was there in 1933, the only bullying that was done was by the actual squad itself. Nothing to do with the NCOs or the trained soldier, but there was one in particular individual who was always scruffy, never washed himself, stank to high heaven, and one day, five of the squad took him into the shower bars and gave him a proper scrubbing down with those floor scrubbers, which didn't he didn't appreciate very much. But he did the trick. From that moment on, he had a wash. I mean, that was the only sign of any bullying that I saw, other than being shouted at.
What was the background of the kind of recruits that you were with?
Well, they came from all over the place, but in the coast stream, and of course a lot of them came from the north of England, and around the sort of coast stream area in Berwickshire and Northumberland, and there were quite a lot of Geordies there. But they were all round, and it was fascinating, really, because I don't know why, I suppose it was the first signs of leadership breaking into one, but there were lots of problems, people being away from home for the first time, people were lonely, people were left girlfriends behind, and the standard of education was pretty dismal. A lot of them couldn't even write, certainly a lot of them couldn't read, and I don't know, I suppose it was my education, and they realized that I had got a bit of education, and they didn't mold me up too much about that, but they used to come to me quite often for advice, and quite often I used to write letters to their girlfriends, which they dictated to me to write. And that, somehow, I learned an awful lot from that in being able to communicate to in every walk of life, and I think it's something that stood me in tremendously throughout the rest of my life. And it's the sort of first basis of communication, which is the secret to my mind of all success. If you can communicate, you can do anything, as long as you communicate the right thing. And so that was very interesting. We hardly ever had a chance to... I think we were allowed out after a month. We were then allowed out for one Saturday night. And we were inspected when we went out, that our uniform was okay, and we were inspected when we came in. And we went to the local sort of shops, and then we went to the local boozer for a bit, and but we were very well supervised and very closely supervised for the whole of that 6 months. Well, then,
we leave that subject, when you first came in, were you giving a medical?
Oh Lord, yes, and that was quite a tough one. And we were when the whole squad was when we all joined up together, 24 of us. Almost, I think I'm right saying, it was almost the first thing that everybody, we had a whole platoon, whole squad, went to the regimental medical officer. And I think it took quite a long time. And it wasn't just cough. It was, we were put through it and tested quite seriously. And I remember there were one or two rejections, who either flat feet or something. And so that was... quite a serious matter, because you were put through an awful lot of exercise in the day. I mean, whether it was PT till you were flogged, you would then go and play football, and then you'll do an hour's solid drill on the square, which does take it out of you, especially when you're being, you know, every single second you've got to concentrate. Then you'd go up, rush, just a minute to change, and then you'd rush up on the range, and your program was absolutely packed full. The food was substantial, but not particularly good. In those days, and I know that I took off a lot of weight to start with, and then I started putting it on again, because one has got hardened and muscled up a bit. Those desperate PT exercises you had to do, putting yourself up and down ropes and things, and Oh, I suppose it did a lot of good. And one appreciated it afterwards. It was quite an interesting thought that this, the you have a sergeant and a corporal in charge of your 24 men, and an officer and a company commander. And the sergeant was a very gentle type chap and was nice and understanding, but you didn't want to get the wrong side of him. And there was a corporal whose name is Joel, and he knocked the stuffing out of me. He didn't think I was very good to start with, and he chased me as much as anybody. And the interesting thing was that about, I don't know how many years later, when I was commanding a parachute regiment, regimental sergeant major of that particular battalion, was then Sergeant Major Joel, having been Corporal Joel. And I said to him, when I first came as the commanding officer, I had him into the office, and I said, "Very nice to see you, Sergeant Major. We've met before." He said, "Yes, sir, we have." And I said, "You took the hell out of me when I was down there." He said, "You've got to watch it now, boy." And he said, "I'm a great privilege to serve with you again, sir." I said, "Yes, you just had to say that, didn't you?" However, we had a very good relationship then. It worked out very well indeed. Then I went to the 3rd Battalion of the Coldstream, who were then in Chelsea Barracks, and did normal duties at outside Buckingham Palace, outside St. James's, doing the Bank of England, long periods of standing, and not being allowed to smile at all the girls who stopped and tried to make you smile, because you knew that the regimental sergeant major or some company sergeant major was standing in plain clothes watching you, and if you moved your lips, you had about 8 days to barracks when you got home. So you were the standard of a drill, and the question of keeping up the standards was very strong indeed. Where do we get to from there? From there, I just did normal duties. We went off from London duties occasionally to Salisbury Plain and did some field training and section training and shooting, and very keen on shooting. And I happened to be quite a good shot, which was an extraordinary thing. Got into the Daily Telegraph Cup team, which won the record score. And so that was made me fairly popular with the hierarchy. And perhaps they then said, well, perhaps this chap had to be a corporal. So I did an NCO's course, at which the young ensigns who just joined as officers also joined in. And the present colonel of the Coldstream Guards, Major General, was George Burns, and he was then Ensign Burns, and I was then acting Lance Corporal, but full corporal, because in the Coldstream you always wear two stripes, Mog. And I always remember the ensigns used to do their drill in their smart city suits with a bowler hat and umbrella. And George Burns was in front of me, and he got his umbrella between his legs and made arse over tip. On the ground, and I handed my rifle to another guardsman and picked him up. And at the 50 years of Coldstreamer dinner, he recounted this story. He said, "The only reason that I've ever became a general is because I picked him up on drill square."
What but kind of things did you learn on this course?
Well, it was mostly drill again and practice at giving words of command to a drill squad. Because, I mean, the Hussar Brigade in those days, they're doing public duties, their drill had to be absolutely number one, and of course it was. So it was mostly that, but you also did have weapon training classes, which again, you had to come out and take the squad yourself in teaching them how to manipulate the Lewis gun, for instance, as we had in those days, the great sort of round thing on the top of it, and the rifle.
Which was the
303,
wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. So I think that the subjects on that course were certainly mostly drill, a little bit of weapon training, a certain little bit of education and current affairs, that sort of thing. Anyhow, I passed that and became a corporal. And one of the reasons, I think, was too, there was a very famous regimental sergeant major called Tibby Britton, Sergeant Major Britton, who was fairly well known as the man with a five-mile voice. And suddenly I'd walk across the square, and I heard this awful voice, "Corporal Mogg," you know, shouting right across the square, "Come here!" And so I then doubled across the square and stamped my feet about 15 miles into the ground. And he said, "I understand you play rugby football." I said, "Yes, Sergeant Major." He said, Don't call me Swami, just call me sir. And so I said, yes, right, be down there at 2:30. And I then have got into the Coldstream rugby team. And from that moment on, Swami Ritten and I were great friends. If I had failed that, I think I'd have got to sack. However, that was just another little snippet.
Did being a corporal change your way of life in any way? Were the accommodation and things different?
It's a good question, that, Harry, if I may say so. I think the corporal's job in the army is probably the most difficult of all, because one minute you're sleeping in a barrack room of 24 and the guy next to you comes in probably full of beer or something, and you help put him to bed and look after him. And as I said, mentioned earlier on, you probably read his letters for him and write his letters for him. And you're great friends with him and probably go out in plain clothes in the evening with him. The next minute, you're on parade and you are the boss. And so it makes it very much more difficult to suddenly have to change from being a close friend to and being fairly friendly with them. Whereas a sergeant lives in the sergeant's mess. And the lives in sergeant's quarters and has a separate rooms and all that sort of thing. But when you're living in a barrack with them, to be able to be aloof one minute and rapping out the orders at the next minute being very friendly is not very easy. I think of all jobs, the corporal's job is the most difficult and probably perhaps one of the most important in the army. And it's amazing how people don't realize that. And then quite a lot of them, I found later on, lost a little bit of ambition to become sergeants or even to become officers because they saw living in a sergeant's mess or officer's mess extra expense and extra responsibility. And the responsibility, sometimes they shied at. And they were much happier going along as a guardsman or in ordinary rifle regiment as a rifleman. And so, you're quite that right. It's a very good point there. We
haven't talked about pay. What was your pay when you started?
Lord, I was just thinking, as you were going along when I made a corporal, I think my pay was about 4 shillings a day, I think. It could have been slightly less than that. Certainly, I know that when I became an officer later on, my pay as an officer, second lieutenant, was 10 shillings a day, which is, what, less than 50p now, isn't it? And I'll come on to that later when we come to officers. But it gave one enough. Of course, my old grandmother used to help me too, of course. You see, I used to get about £50 a year from her, so I was fairly rich amongst, but I tried not to show it in any way. And that actually saved quite a lot of money from in that way. The main things, when you were at the depot, the only thing you could spend it on was going to the Neffy and have eggs and bacon or something like that, and a glass of beer. Of course, being in London, there were temptations at which you could go out and spend a lot more money. But you can't spend much on 4 shillings a day.
Would it be a reasonable question to ask you to go through a typical day as a corporal in the Guards, starting with Reveille?
My memory is very dim. First thing you hear is that Reveille in the morning, the bugles training outside. That's the first thing you hear. And you suddenly find then that the sergeant or the corporal who's on duty would come around, wakey, wakey, and you'd sleepy, give yourself a wash, and then have breakfast. And then if you are on duties at 11 o'clock that day, your whole morning would be taken up on finishing off the kit which you've cleaned all day the day before. And before the, whatever it is, 10 o'clock guard mounting, which you either did if it was Buckingham Palace, in the forecourt of Buckingham Palace, or if it was at St. James's Palace, you formed up on the square of Wellington Barracks or Chelsea and went to St. James's Palace, or any of the other guards. And that was really, your life in London was really public duties. And so it was either getting ready for guard or resting from being on guard. And then if you were off duties and there were time in London, there were various courses which you would be doing, like weapon training, education, PT, and sport in a very big way. I mean, I used to play both cricket and rugby and hockey for the Coldstream. And we used to play a lot in Burton's Court, which was a very nice cricket ground and football ground. And one did quite a lot of going down, for instance, to Bisley and practicing for rifle competitions.